So let's start with Texas. 1830s, Mexico, Mexican government, which had recently become free from Spain, has this territory of Texas that is very sparsely populated with Mexicans. And so they invite the Americans in. Why do they invite the Americans in? What's Mexico's goal with this invitation that they have extended? Anybody? They're not. I don't think that they're dreaming quite that big. And again, why would they want Americans occupying their territory? What's in it for Mexico? What do the Americans provide or bring with them that's advantageous to Mexico? Okay. I'm sorry? You're very, very close. To serve as a buffer. So if you imagine that, you know, the bulk of Mexicans are living well south of Texas, of present-day Texas. And where are the bulk of the Indians at that particular time?
A little bit above that.
Like where? In what modern-day state? They're in Oklahoma. Remember, we've moved them there. Okay, there's lots and lots and lots of Indians in Oklahoma. Okay, and so they're having raids on into Texas. By inviting the Americans into Texas, that creates a buffer. Okay, the Americans will catch the arrows first. The Americans may kill the Indians first before we have to deal with them. So part of it is almost a military strategy. The second thing is that Americans bring with them money. They are hoping that to trade. They're hoping to gin up some commerce in the area. So it's partially military or security reasons that Mexico's extending the invitation, and the other is economic. Now, who goes to Texas? What's the motive for an American to move to Texas? Okay, you've got a handful of people: Bowie, Crockett, Austin, Travis, who are going as impresarios, as hired land speculators. They are going to be the first ones there to kind of plat off the lots and to then hopefully recruit other Americans to come into the territory. All right, so that takes care of maybe, you know, five, a dozen, two dozen people. What about the other folks? Why are they coming? What does the Gulf Coast of Texas offer? It offers really good land for farming, for cotton farming. So you've wanted to get into the cotton plantation business. All the good land was already spoken for and too expensive in Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arkansas, and Georgia. Okay, here is an opportunity for you as somebody who has very little money to start your own cotton plantation. So all you need are a few slaves, and the land is very cheap, and you can start. And all it's required is that you declare an oath of loyalty to the Mexican government, and nominally you have to swear allegiance to the Roman Catholic Church. But nobody was going to make you go to Mass or anything. You just had to say, yes, I pledge allegiance to the Mexican government and the Church of Rome. And you're done. You're now a Mexican. I don't think you're a Mexican citizen, but you're a legal resident of Texas. What causes the party to come to an end? What does Mexico do that causes the party to come to an end? About 8 or 9 years after the original invitation was extended.
Slavery, right?
That's right. No more slavery. So if you've come there, and you've invested time, money, effort, and then I say no more slavery, that's going to be difficult. Now, there are other things going on as well. The Mexican governments were incredibly unstable. And so what the rules were and weren't, who's really in charge this week, that was always somewhat of a mystery. It's going to be one of the paradoxes that the United States government's going to have to face when it fights the Mexican-American War. So instability with the Mexican government and the outlawing of slavery, those are the two reasons cited by most historians as what causes what we're going to call now the War for Texan Independence. Okay? And one of the things that's difficult, because there's two wars that are separated by about 8 or 9 years. There's this War for Texan Independence, and then there's the Mexican-American War. The War for Texan Independence is the only Americans who are fighting in that war are Texans. Okay? The United States government, the United States military, as far as I know, isn't lending one iota of support for this war effort. So it's in some indigenous Texans, okay, some people who would appear to the average person today to be of Hispanic descent, and a lot of people who used to live in, let's say, Arkansas or Tennessee, who are now Texans. The war is relatively short. If you needed to know any two battles, the two that stand out in the story are the Battle at the Alamo, which is a converted Roman Catholic mission, and basically then gets turned into a fort by the Texans, and they very famously hold off Santa Ana for 10 days or something like that, hold off a force of like 4,000 troops with less than 200 men, and they fight down famously to the last man. And while that's going on, that allowed Sam Houston to recruit more soldiers, and to just a month or two down the road at the Battle of San Jacinto capture Santa Ana and force Santa Ana into signing a surrender treaty. So now Texas is an independent country. It's an independent republic. What's Texas's nickname today? What's its nickname?
Star State.
The Lone Star State. And that goes back to its time as an independent republic. Because if you looked at the Texas flag right after it achieved independence from Mexico, their flag, the Texas flag, looked very much like the American flag, except for there's just one star on a field of blue and a red stripe and a white stripe, and then that's the flag of Texas. Okay. And Sam Houston is the president of Texas. How come it's not immediately annexed into the United States? How come Texas isn't almost immediately annexed into becoming an American state? Yeah, okay. So you have a lot of Northerners who do not want to add yet another slave state. They're afraid not just of adding another slave state, but if you take this War for Texan Independence and you marry that then to the ideology of manifest destiny, if you're a Northerner, what are you predicting is going to happen a year, two, 3 years down the road? And what do you mean by keep growing? You're right. What do you mean it'll be keep growing? What will happen? And what do you mean expand? Sydney. What do you mean it won't stop? Give me specific. What do you mean it won't stop? I'm a sixth grader on the bus. What do you mean it won't stop? Keep going to what other states?
Western territories.
Western territories. Okay. You've got to use specific language. You can't just say it's going to keep going, it's going to expand. It will continue to expand westward. In other words, we would probably continue to fight more wars with Mexico in order to get more slave territory. Okay, that's the fear. Andrew Jackson, slave owner himself, doesn't want to annex Texas. One, because he's afraid of the tensions it would create within the United States. It will create a domestic problem. Secondly, the treaty is a little slippery. You know, because again, who's in charge of Mexico, and really does the Mexican government have to abide by a treaty signed by one of its generals? Okay, so and even if we are, say the Mexican government, going to abide by the treaty, there's dispute as to what the western border of the treaty is. Is it the Rio Grande, which is what the United States, what the Texans say it is, or is it the Nueces, which is closer in? In other words, if you took the if you took the best possible case of the Mexican interpretation, Mexican government's interpretation of that treaty, it's, you know, the Nueces is the western border of the new Republic of Texas, whereas the Texans were claiming all the way to the Rio Grande. So Jackson doesn't want to annex, is counseling against annexation of Texas, in that he doesn't want to create, doesn't want to see turmoil domestically, nor does he want to see a secondary war with Mexico. So it's put, Texas is kind of shoved aside in terms of a discussion of it for the next several years. It's kind of hanging out there. And it's going to probably have to be dealt with soon, but we're not going to deal with it right now. Questions on Texan independence?
I have a
lame
question.
Okay.
What, the Indians have a role in the Civil War at all?
Mm-hmm. And if you'll remember that question, I'll answer it next week. Okay? I will go ahead and give you a teaser trailer. The last general who surrendered for the Confederacy was a Confederate general, Cherokee Indian, out in Oklahoma. The last general who surrendered for the Confederacy. And, of course, right here in western North Carolina, William Holland Thomas raised Thomas's Raiders, if you know, and 300 Cherokee Braves. And then the hardcore Cherokee fundamentalists, the Kiowa, they fight for the Union. But we'll get into a little bit more of that next week. Anything else on Texan independence? Just one more thing. I've been always fascinated by Texas, Texas's politics. I believe for the last 20 years that there are at least three political parties in the United States. There's the Democratic Party, there's the Republican Party, and then there's Texas. When you look at the presidencies of George W. Bush and the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, you know, a conservative Republican and a very liberal Democrat, so many similarities there, I think, and some important differences. But Texans have this independent streak. And of course, you've got a senator from Texas right now that is quite colorful. Next to John McCain, he's taking up most of the airtime. So Google Ted Cruz, Cruz, and look at what Ted Cruz is saying on the television. Texas isn't boring.
Do they still use the electric chair?
No, they're lethal injection.
No. I heard the bill talking about how they
go
through.
No. No, they're. I think everybody's lethal injection now. We're fully humane.
When did they outlaw
I think Kansas or Nebraska are the last states that stop. But of course, Utah very famously in 82 or 83 used firing squad.
Like 1982?
Like 1982.
Oh,
Gary Gilmore was executed by firing squad. Because that was the form of execution in Utah.
I was wondering what he did. Was he like a serial killer or just killed someone?
He was just a murderer.
They didn't do that to other murderers?
Well, but they hadn't had an executed. There was a moratorium on the death penalty in this country. We need to. I need to stick to this. You guys are horrible. The next item here, let's see. Well, let's go to James Polk. There you have an original 13 colonies. You have Louisiana Purchase. And then you have James K. Polk. 13 colonies, Andrew Jackson, War of 1812, Thomas Jefferson, Louisiana Purchase plus the War of 1812, the War for Texan Independence, followed by annexation in 1845. And then everything else that you see here, with the exception of the Gadsden Purchase, all comes into the United States under Polk. Okay? So all of this and all of that and this, that's Polk. And nobody knows who he is. And my colleague, Mr. Johnson, would argue, and I would agree with him, that you might be able to characterize Polk as the most effective and efficient president in American history. Polk has a very simple platform in 1846. Here's his platform. Point one, I'm going to annex Texas. Point two, 5440 or fight, meaning I am going to take all the Oregon country all the way up to the 5440 line. And if you look at that map over there, and you see the masking tape up where Canada is, that's the 5440 line. So he's basically saying the border, the southern border of what is now Oregon, all the way up now through what is Washington State, and then north of that, all the way to that 5440 line, that's what he is planning to take from Great Britain. 5440 or fight. They're going to give it to us or we're going to go to war. That was promise two. So promise one, annex Texas. Promise two, 5440 or fight. Promise number three, I am going to buy California. Promise number four, I'm only going to serve one term. Boom. And by the way, he hates the bank too. Polk is a clone in many respects of Andrew Jackson. Born in North Carolina, moved to Tennessee. Jackson was his mentor. His nickname is Little Hickory. He is a big believer in manifest destiny like Jackson. He is a strong believer in relatively minimal federal government. He is going to go after the bank as well. He is going to go after the reducing the tariff as well. All right, so the election's very close between Polk and, God bless him, Henry Clay again. And the reason Clay loses the election is he keeps his timing on what to do with Texas and California is wrong. At first, you know, he's like, no, not annex Texas. Certainly, let's not go after California. And then when it looks clearly like public opinion is going in that direction, then he switches, which then only alienates the Northerners that had been supporting him to that point and not winning over a single Southerner. So it's a close election, but Polk wins.
You're
4 years away from his brokered compromise of 1850. Okay, and that's his last hurrah.
How old is he at this
point? Late 50s, early 60s, I think. Maybe mid 60s at this point. 63, 64. Okay, so Polk's elected in November. Before Polk is inaugurated the following March, it's very clear to the American Congress that the American people, by supporting Polk, favor annexation. So they don't even wait for Polk to get inaugurated. Texas is annexed. Check mark off that promise. Let's drop down to the purchase of California. Every American, I think, who was politically savvy knew that Mexico wasn't just going to sign California over because of a check. In other words, when Polk said, "I'm going to buy California," what was he really telling the American people was going to happen? If he says, "I'm going to get California, I'm going to buy it," and everybody knows that the chances of Mexico selling it are almost zero, what do people think is going to happen? We're going to go to war. In other words, Polk ran on a platform of, we're going to war. Okay, so wrap your head around that. Okay, the voters were voting to go to war. Okay. And then take his other campaign slogan, 54-40 or fight. And if one war isn't good enough for you, how about two? This guy wins an election. That's how strong I think this notion of manifest destiny is. Not just in the South, but among a lot of Northerners as well. But there was also, there were the people who were preaching caution. Ralph Waldo Emerson saying, Mexico will surely poison us. If we get into this war, it's going to rip us apart. So, now Polk has won the election. Texas has been annexed. And, of course, we're claiming the Rio Grande. Mexico says, no, it's the Nueces, if it's anything at all. If you want to go to war, and you're an American president, and you're leading a country that is based on the Declaration of Independence, you cannot appear, what I'm saying to you, this next sentence is maybe one of the 10 or 15 most important things I'll tell you all semester. It's one of these fundamental truths, I would argue, about who we are as people. The American people do not like to see themselves or their country go to war for imperial reasons. We will do whatever it takes to see ourselves as a non-imperialistic country. We do not want to see any of the wars that we have fought in the past, the present, or the future as some sort of strictly offensive maneuver in order to gain land or wealth or dominance over another people. We want to see ourselves, as we do in this Gadsden flag right here, as the rattlesnake that only attacks when it is itself attacked. That's how we like to see ourselves. We only attack when we're attacked. And the war with Mexico, I would argue, is the beginning of the American government facilitating, enabling, manufacturing what is known as a casus belli, as a cause, a reason for war. And I would argue to you that Polk is going to manufacture a reason for this war with Mexico, that he politically has to manufacture a reason to go to war with Mexico, because without that, he's not going to get the critical support. If you're a commander-in-chief of the United States Army and government, you are still a commander-in-chief of an army that rests on top of a democracy. And so having popular support at your back and not as a headwind is essential to any war that you're going to fight. It's essential in the Mexican-American War. It's going to be essential in a war in the Philippines. And we're going to talk about what happens to McKinley in that war, how there starts to be lots and lots and lots of brushback on that war, and how McKinley and later on Roosevelt negotiate that. When we fight World War I, we will create a whole branch of the government, the Committee on Public Information, designed to do one thing: create propaganda and to propagandize the American public. We will do something very similar in World War II. Not so much during Korea, but during Vietnam, there is a constant stream of disinformation and misinformation out of the American government. It's not something that I'm hypothesizing. Okay, that's confirmed fact. We know it from the government's own records that they were falsifying information that they disseminated to the American public in order to maintain popular support for the war. And that we got into that war. We got into the war with Vietnam over what is generally agreed upon now as a manufactured incident, the Gulf of Tonkin incident. So how does Polk get into this war? Well, he sends Zachary Taylor down to the Nueces and has him then cross that and get right up to the Rio Grande, and there's a skirmish with Mexican troops. And those Mexican troops then pursue Taylor and his troops to an area that the United States government is going to claim is American sovereign territory. In other words, what will Polk claim to the United States Congress? What has Mexico done? They have invaded America. They are the aggressor. They are the aggressor. There is a vocabulary term that should be on your list that's not on your list. And that vocabulary term is spot resolution. Do you remember at all from last fall what the spot resolution... Huh? It is on there? All right. I didn't think it was. Does anybody know what the spot resolution is? Can you get the volume up? That's exactly right. Lincoln, a first-term congressman from Illinois, stands up and basically is calling the President of the United States a liar. Okay, that's what he's doing. I want you to show me the spot where this so-called invasion happened. Lincoln is a Northern Whig. Lincoln sees this war in very simple terms. This is a war for the extension of the institution of slavery. It is an imperial effort, and I'm going to do what I think is clever to try to stop this. It doesn't work. There is a great letter that Lincoln writes to one of his constituents about how America is different from the land of kings, that American presidents don't have absolute right to go to war with whomever they want, whenever they wish. He comes across as a squishy liberal, an anti-war beatnik. And that letter will be waved in his face by some Northern Democrats during the Civil War. Hey, remember what you said about Polk and too much control, too much authority being invested in a president when it comes to war-making authority? Well, what about that now, Abe? The office changes you. The situation changes you. But I think it's noteworthy to know that Lincoln is calling Polk out. Now, that doesn't work. There's another effort by another northern congressman to change the rules of the war or to change the outcome of the war. What is David Wilmot's proviso? What is that? No slavery what?
In the whole, like, everything they just got from Mexico.
Okay, except for we haven't gotten anything from Mexico. Okay, so you're very close. It's no slavery in any land that we might get from Mexico. Okay. The proviso comes up. Here's what the situation is. Polk is out of money. He's fighting this war with Mexico, and he needs more money from Congress. One of the things that tends to escape most Americans, especially during like the war with Iraq and Afghanistan, they said, well, you know, the president needs to stop this war. The president needs to stop this war. How can Congress stop any war at once?
Stop funding it.
Okay? So anytime you ever hear, like you did during the latter stages of the war with Iraq, you heard the Democrats complaining about the president fighting a war and what, you know, we needed to stop. They could have pulled the plug. They could stop writing the checks. And that war will be over pretty quickly. Okay. Now, you're going to look like the Federalist Party at the Hartford Convention. You're going to look like a traitor if you're not supporting the troops. But if you've got moral courage, and you have courage of your convictions, you can choose to stop funding it. So, back to Mexico and the Wilmot Proviso. Polk needs more money, and what Wilmot's basically saying is, I will provide you, I'll vote to give you more money, Mr. President, but I'm going to add a little rider here to your request for more funds. My proviso says any land that we acquire from Mexico will be free of slavery. Is Wilmot an abolitionist? He is not. He is, like the vast majority of Northerners, not moralizing so much on the institution of slavery. He just doesn't want to see it spread. It's icky, and he doesn't want to give more power to the South. He's a capitalist. He's a Pennsylvania capitalist who wants wage labor as opposed to slavery, and wants capitalism as opposed to agrarian feudalism. That's his vision for America. The proviso passes the House of Representatives, where the North has a clear majority. Where does it stop? It stops in the Senate. Why is the Wilmot Proviso such a big deal? It brings up the issue. It brings it up in Technicolor with halogen headlights on it. Okay? That you've got a northern congressman here who is attempting to stop the spread of slavery. And by this time, by 1847, 1848, when the proviso is introduced, there is increasing legitimate paranoia on a part of the South that there are powerful elements in the North that want to limit the institution. And again, in the Southern mind, and I think this is a legitimate line of thought, that if slavery isn't expanding, it's dying. If slavery is not expanding, it's surely dying. And here is a northern congressman, and not only did he propose this, but he got a majority of the North to go along with it. That's scary. That's terrifying. Okay. So the proviso ultimately fails. The United States will win its war with Mexico and negotiates this border right here, Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, secures that border. We do end up writing Mexico a check, so it's all nice and legal. We didn't take it by warfare. You'll notice on the map it says Mexican cession. We didn't take it by brute force. They sold it to us. That gives us now Mexico, Nevada, Utah, part of the territory of Colorado, and then all of present-day Arizona and New Mexico. In the middle of the war with Mexico, negotiations are going on with Great Britain over what? The Oregon Territory. And so James Buchanan's Secretary of State under Polk, and so he's going back and forth, back and forth. Great Britain knows that Polk doesn't want two wars at once, that he doesn't want a two-front war. So Polk goes back and forth between playing hardball and not so hardball with Great Britain, and eventually the two countries decide to split the difference. So we got half the Oregon Territory. We get it up to the 49th parallel, not the 54th parallel. And call it a day. So, how did Polk do with his platform? I'm going to annex Texas. I'm going to get California. 54-40 or fight. He kept 2.5 of his promises. Three and a half. He served one term. He went home. And about 2 months later, he died.
It's such a bad ending.
No, it's not. You've accomplished your life's work. It's time to lay down. Huh?
You did all of that in one term.
Yeah.
It's pretty effective.
Polk is a fascinating character. Polk, he's not terribly eloquent, but one of the things that you have got to understand, with the exception of a couple of our vice presidents who are accidental, they're accidental presidents. You don't get to be in the White House unless you're a really sharp politician. That's, the movie Lincoln is a flawed film in many respects, but one of the things about that movie that is good is it shows Lincoln as a politician, as a wheeler dealer. Okay? I'll show different faces to different people to get my way. They're all like that. George Washington could wheel and deal. Adams, a little bit. Clay, of course, Clay was the master. Doesn't get into the White House. Lincoln was a master politician. Teddy Roosevelt's a master politician. All right. Now we have California. You've got a gold rush in California. And that brings us to where we were yesterday, to the Compromise of 1850. And I said there were basically four parts of that you ought to know. California came in free. You've got the territories of, I guess it's New Mexico and Utah. They're going to be slavery will be decided by popular sovereignty. You have the ending of the slave trade in Washington, D.C., and then what's the big one that the South gets? Fugitive slave law. And we talked about the case yesterday of an escaped slave making his way to Boston. In this ultimate showdown in downtown Boston, at the courthouse with a slave barricaded inside the courthouse, protected by abolitionists and sharpshooters, and forcing the federal government to extract that slave with the United States Army, and how that had the effect of radicalizing. That's a verb that you need to know. Radicalize. Somebody was rather indifferent, okay? Matt was really, didn't think it was a big deal as to whether or not Fourth Amendment rights were respected in high schools. He, you know, it's like, well, you know, drug dog, that's, you know, that's not really a big deal, you know. Walker searches what it is. And then one day, Matt is taken out of the room and strip searched by three SROs. They're still convinced he's got contraband on him somewhere. They take him to the hospital. They force him to have an MRI. He's questioned nonstop for 36 hours. And his family is all detained and questioned. How important is the Fourth Amendment to you now? It's incredibly important, okay? This event has now radicalized you. You now are like, by God, the Fourth Amendment is the most important thing. He's got the Fourth Amendment Association for Students, and I mean, it just, you know, he's been radicalized. These events, these pursuits of escaped slaves in the northern states it's going to be one of the things that's going to start to radicalize some northerners to become more anti-slavery. If not for moral reasons, economic reasons, but you're going to have more start to oppose it on moral grounds. Any questions on the Compromise of 1850 and the Fugitive Slave Law? I talked about that one yesterday.
Can I go to the back
one? Sure. Let's talk about Uncle Tom's Cabin. In the 19th century, the number one selling book in the United States was the King James Bible. The number two best-selling book in the 19th century in the United States was Uncle Tom's Cabin. Okay, Bible, Uncle Tom's Cabin. Who wrote it?
Harriet Beecher Stowe.
And where did Harriet Beecher Stowe grow up? Where? I'm sure you're aware that there are cities in the north. Which city in the north did she grow up in? It's very important, I think, if you want to understand Harriet Beecher Stowe and where she's coming from, it's essential to know her city. Cincinnati. What's the big deal about growing up in Cincinnati in the 1830s, the 1840s, the 1850s? I'll help you out. That's Cincinnati. Say what?
You see slavery, but you're not a part of it.
How is it that she sees slavery?
And she's right next to a border state, so they have slavery.
Was, for argument's sake, let's say that Harriet Beecher Stowe never went to Kentucky. What does she nevertheless experience?
Runaway slaves.
Runaway, lots of them. The slaves will recall the Ohio River, the River Jordan. Why do they call it the River Jordan? Let's see who went to Sunday school here and who are my pagans. Why do they call it the River Jordan?
Because the country passed through slavery.
That's right. You're there's milk and honey on the other side. Glory, hallelujah. You're away from Pharaoh. You're safe now. Okay. So she grows up in Cincinnati, listening to the stories of runaway slaves. And these are not pleasant, put your six-year-old to bed stories. These are rip your guts out stories. These stories of being beaten, mutilated, raped. But what's the most heart-wrenching story any slave can tell?
They got captured.
Say again?
They were captured.
No, what's the most... That's. Say again? Separated from families. It's the number one fear. I can handle anything. I can handle the mutilation. I can handle the beating. I can handle any physical torment. But to have your child sold away from you, knowing that you're never going to see that kid again. To have your wife sold away, knowing you were never going to see her again. To know that your whole existence rested on such a precarious balance. It's the precariousness of your situation is found in the wedding vows. The wedding vows of a slave marriage, till death or circumstance do we part. Till death or circumstance. Knowing that that's always possible, that master is going to sell one of us away from the other. Particularly scary time was when the master died, and that estate's going to have to be broken apart to pay off the debts. Or these five slaves go to this kid, these six slaves go to that one, those go to my wife, and so forth. So Harriet Beecher Stowe grows up. She is in a family of ministers. Brother's a minister, dad's a minister, cousins, uncles. I think she marries one. So she listens to those stories and writes the book. There are no movies. There's no internet. There's no photograph. There's very few photographs of slavery that make their way into the North. Most of you have had this experience. You read a novel, you went to see the movie, and you came out of the movie, and what did you say? It's not as good as the book. And there's one reason why the movie will never be as good as the book, is because that director cannot get into Emily Curtis's head and figure out exactly what the hero would have looked like and how he would have acted or so on. Okay, your imagination is always deeper, spiritually deeper, than anything that's going to be depicted up on the screen. So, while we may think that a novel isn't as powerful as a movie, frequently it is as powerful as a movie, and sometimes it's more powerful than a movie. So here's this novel, again, second best-selling book throughout the 19th century, and women in the North start to read it. And they fall apart. They fall apart on the scenes where the kids are being sold away from their mom, because every mother can identify with that slave mama. She can put herself in the shoes of that woman and say, oh my God, what would I do if my little Cindy and Tommy and Billy were sold away from me? And then she'll hand that book to her best friend. You need to read this. Which is what women do with novels. They read it and then they force their best friend, you've got to read this book. Right. Put down that Cosmo and read this. This is way better. Okay. So it sweeps. Okay. This thing is everywhere. So forget the fact that it's the bestseller. It's just like Thomas Paine's Common Sense. You know, the copies that are just passed along. And so, again, this book has the impact of radicalizing. You were on the fence, you didn't really care about slavery last week, but now because you've read about the horrors of families being split up and the beatings, now you think you understand slavery, and by God, something ought to happen to limit this horror. There is a story, perhaps apocryphal meaning is perhaps just legendary, of Abraham Lincoln meeting Harriet Beecher Stowe somewhere around 1863 and saying, "So, you're the little lady that started this great big war."
What'd she say?
Go Yankees! I don't know. She would not have felt bad. Look, the brother and the dad, when the abolitionists are out in Kansas trying to make Kansas a free state, at daddy and brother or husband's church in Boston, they're taking up collections in the church to buy Beecher's Bibles. What are Beecher's Bibles? Repeating right, okay, guns to go kill pro-slave people. Okay, these were very practical Christians. He needs killing. Okay. All right, Kansas-Nebraska Act. Kansas-Nebraska. The brainchild of Senator from Illinois, Stephen Douglas. There are, after the Mexican-American War, there is a debate as to what the route should be for a transcontinental railroad. The reason that you see this little strip of land down here, this Gadsden Purchase, says 1853, the reason that the United States goes back to Mexico long after the war and buys this extra little piece of land was that was really flat and was thought, okay, this would be a perfect place to build that particular leg of the Transcontinental Railroad. So there's a debate in the country, where do you build the railroad? Do you have primarily a southern route, or do you have more of a northern route? And the two sections go back and forth on which it should be. Now, ultimately, which route's taken? Huh? No. Yeah, the north, and how does it end up? Here's one of those easy hard questions. Why does the north get the route? Huh? Because the north, the south seceded, and the north's like, all right, here we go. Okay, it's very interesting. You know, there's three key pieces of legislation that that pass as soon as the south goes. Because it's not just about the Civil War. All right, the North's like, okay, they're gone. Now we can get our northern route. The Homestead Act, which the North had wanted for a long time to open up these lands, that had been blocked by the South. Now that's a go. Currency Act. So all this stuff been blocked by the South, and North's going to finally get. Let's go back to Stephen Douglas in the middle of 1850s. Douglas wants a northern route because Douglas is from Illinois. And what Douglas wants is he wants Chicago to be the terminus of the Transcontinental Railroad. And so in his mind, it ought to start in Chicago or be hooked up to Chicago. It ought to come right through here, through Missouri, and then work its way through Kansas and Nebraska and the Platte River Valley and on out to Sacramento. Now, if you built it, what would happen to Franklin if 441 was turned into an interstate? Uh-huh. What would happen to Franklin?
Would it become a city?
Well, we already are a city.
A legit city.
A legit city, okay. A big one. Okay. We would, simple, our population would explode, all right? If you build a railroad through Kansas, what's going to happen to Kansas? And therefore, it would cease to become a territory, and it would then be eligible for statehood. And how come the South doesn't want that railroad going through Kansas? Well, not probably.
It would.
Why would Kansas necessarily be free?
Missouri Compromise
said anything north of that 3630 line was going to be free if it was to ever become a state. But Douglas has a plan. Okay, let's get rid of that old Missouri Compromise. It's time to move on. Okay. Let's have popular sovereignty. Let's let the people of Kansas decide what will happen to Kansas. It's not up to the United States government. Let the people of... What can be more democratic than that? Having the people decide. Okay? Now, the South is like, oh yeah, we can go along with your railroad plan because now there's at least a chance that Kansas can go slave.
Didn't like some Southerners go up to Kansas to vote for slavery?
Yeah. Of course they did. Of course they did. I mean, let me just fast forward this now since you're already there. Let's make it a contemporary example. This is the North Pole. This is the North Pole. It is a forbidding, hard place to live. I don't know if you saw on the news last night, but the United States just purchased the North Pole from Russia. Okay. We now have clear title to the North Pole. Okay.
So when it melts, will be our fault?
Well, no, it won't be our fault. But here's the thing. There's a plan already in the works to admit it as our 51st state. And we're gonna admit it as a state. And there was part of the deal that in this legislation that was written last night is that whatever the voters of this new 51st state decide, that will be law for the rest of the country on two issues: gay marriage and abortion.
Oh my God.
Okay. Whatever the people of the North Pole decide. And actually, I'm sorry, there's one other issue: ownership of guns. Okay. The three issues that the people of the North Pole are going to be deciding for the rest of the country are gay marriage, abortion, and if there's going to be any gun ownership. Now, I want you to think very clearly, okay, and logically here, who moves to the North Pole?
All the extremists on those issues.
All the extremists, that's right. The ones who are really motivated. The ones, I mean, because it's a hard place to get to, it's a hard place to live in. Just like Kansas in 1856. It's a hard place to get to. It's a hard place to live in. So when people say, well, all the slaveholders, no, not all the slaves. Okay, you're not, oh, yes, I'm here on my nice, comfortable plantation. Yes, let's leave this and go to Kansas. No. Or I'm in my nice Boston drawing room, sipping my tea, reading my Emerson by the fire. Yes, I think I'll go to Kansas and try to keep this horrible institution of slavery from spreading. Or maybe I won't. And, you know, that's it. So it's the most motivated people. So you got the most motivated extremist going to Kansas. Could you have created a pay-per-view event any better than that? Okay, this is a cage match with shotguns and machete swords. Okay, so you have... For the slave folks, they're in a better position because you've got pro-slave folks right here in Missouri. So the Missouri border ruffians come into Kansas. The abolitionists have got further to go. You have John Brown's sons who will come down from the Far East right here all the way out there. But you'll have other abolitionists, and they will go at each other. Very famously, you have the Sack of Lawrence, where the border ruffians go through the town and they slap people around and shoot some windows out and probably a rape or two and just kind of cause Lawrence to have a bad day. And in the middle of all this, then you have John Brown going out there himself, and he finds, in the middle of the night with his sons, finds some people who, some pro-slave people who have been mean and nasty to the abolitionist forces, and in the middle of the night, he pulls them out of their cabins, and they chop them up with their swords. This is the Pottawatomie Massacre. So John Brown makes his bones in Kansas. And Kansas is now said to be bleeding. You have a civil war in microcosm going on in Kansas, 1856, 1857. And there's a competition. You know, that basically what's going to happen is you have two separate governments both claim legitimacy in Kansas. There's a Topeka government and a Lecompton government. And I believe the Topeka one, I might have these swapped, but I believe the Topeka one was the free constitution, the free capital, and Lecompton was the slave one. And now you've got who's in the White House at this time? What many people would say is the worst president in American history. It might not be fair.
Pierce?
Not Pierce. James Buchanan. Buchanan is a northerner. He's a northern Democrat who only got power because Southerners supported him. So don't let Buchanan's Yankee stripes fool you. He's a Southern sympathizer. He's also indecisive. Maybe I would be indecisive too. Which constitution, you know, he's got tremendous influence in the Congress. Which application for statehood should we take? Should we take the Lecompton Constitution? Should we take the Topeka one? Found out recently that it was Buchanan who had his thumb on the scale in the Supreme Court for the Dred Scott case. Questions on Kansas? The Ostend Manifesto, that is a move in the 1850s to go after what? What territory did the South have its eye on to take from Spain?
Cuba.
Keep that in mind when we do Cuba in 1898. We had our eye on Cuba for a long time. Let me quickly go through here and tell you what some stuff that you can line out. So you're starting with Monroe. Collins versus Virginia, you can cross out. McCulloch versus Maryland, Dartmouth College versus Woodward, and Gibbons v. Ogden, those are all martial court decisions. You should be able to boil those down into one sentence. But I do want you to go back and look very quickly at those if you don't have that flashcard done. Cherokee Nation versus Georgia. Let's put a line through that and substitute Worcester versus Georgia. That's the more important case. And we've talked about that when we didn't talk about Cherokee Nation versus Georgia. Worcester versus Georgia. You can put a line through the Independent Treasury Act. You can put a line through William Henry Harrison. Commonwealth versus Hunt. I'm not going to ask you anything specifically about German and Irish immigration or the transatlantic cable and telegraph. I never really said anything about Commodore Perry in Japan. I can't remember the year. What does Perry Japan mean? Anybody know? I'm sorry? He goes to Japan and he basically forces them to start trading with us. Okay. The only reason I think it's important is that we are projecting power that far away at that time. It's also a wake-up call to the Japanese that if they don't militarize along Western lines, they're going to be pushed around. So they militarize along Western lines and they become a very big problem. I'm not going to ask you specific questions about Oneida or Brook Farm, but you should know the basic characteristics of the utopian communities. I never spoke about Seneca Falls. I would hope that you would know that from the fall. It's 1850. It's a women's rights convention. Their declaration of sentiments is based on what? Yeah. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal. What's the number one thing that they are agitating for at Seneca Falls?
Suffrage.
Yeah. And again, so that's 1850, and when do women finally get the right to vote at the federal level? 1920. Women out west will get the right to vote at the state level long before that. I did not speak about Horace Mann and public education. Horace Mann, you have all these reform movements that grow out of the Second Great Awakening. Women's rights, prisoners' rights, reform for how we treat the mentally ill, the temperance movement, the abolitionist movement, the anti-tobacco movement. Public education is a big one too. Public education really gets cranked up in three cities, Boston, probably more than any other city, is where the big public school system movement starts. Philadelphia and New York are right up behind that. Why is there a sudden move in the 1850s? It's not just the Second Great Awakening. Why is there this urgency to do something about public education? What's the phenomenon that's bringing it on? Why? How come we've got to deal with these kids now?
We want to change immigrants' minds.
It's all about immigration. Okay, it's about teaching these immigrants what the Constitution is. It's teaching them English. And if you're like me, you see a little bit of conspiracy theory going on here. I would argue that these early public schools were intensely anti-Catholic. And part of what was animating the public school movement was anti-Catholicism. Catholics will be forbidden from having their own schools in this country for a long time. So it was, you know, let's turn them into Protestants too. And of course, the phenomenon is the same in 2013. You have a huge Hispanic population. You teach them language. You teach them Constitution. You teach them history. And what do you hope happens when they go home? They teach their parents. Okay. And that works. For better or worse, that system works. I'm not going to ask anything about the Liberty Party. anything special about Millard Fillmore or Iowa entering the Union. I'm not aware of anything awesome about Iowa coming into the Union. Or Franklin Pierce. The Know-Nothings, very briefly, the Know-Nothings are anti-Catholic. I think they're important because they serve to, they are a wedge within the Democratic Party. In other words, some Democrats will leave the Democratic Party and join the Know-Nothings. And that's important because as the Democratic Party becomes weak, it allows for the nation to further split apart. And it's going to open the door, the Know-Nothings kind of open the door to finally to the Republican Party to become this new dynamic force in American politics. Questions on anything else that remains? Not going to ask you anything special about John Tyler. We're the Seventh-day Adventists. Where does Seventh-day Adventists start?
Second
Friday. Where? Any Seventh-day Adventists? They start in Michigan, Mary Baker Eddy. And she's cousin to a guy that you've probably heard of, Kellogg. Okay, who it's all about health and wellness. Okay, and so go to Seventh-day Adventist Church. Lots of fruit drives. The physical health really big part of the picture of Seventh-day Adventists. Kellogg. Is there at the very beginning with his healthy breakfast cereals. Okay, so what's fair game for Monday? These terms. The reading on Jackson and Calhoun. I'm not picking nits out of that stuff. It'll be the broad topics we talked about. Jackson's proclamation of South Carolina. Okay. So study for that. You can bring in an 8.5 by 11 front and back cheat sheet on that on Monday. Those of you that didn't get the email from me, please try to reconnect so I can give you permission. If you get hung up tomorrow morning, if you for some reason you can't log in, just type it on Google Docs or something and email it to me. Yeah.
What if we didn't use an email?
Okay, just be able to just log in again. I'm sorry? Yeah.
Today and the boys at 12:45. Also, please dismiss the men's tennis team to go to their match today. And we wish good luck also to varsity baseball and who are going to Raven Gap and to the track team who will be here today. We want to remind you that the Masquerade Dance is going to be March 9th. Tickets are on sale here in the office. Seniors who did not have your porches made over the summer need to meet in the main lobby during break today. Also, HOSA Club needs to meet in the main lobby during break today for your pictures. Anyone who was in Eco Club, please meet in the 4-6 class during break at this time. We want to remind you we have Saturday school this Saturday. For those of you who need to make up time, please come get the form in the office. It needs to be returned to the office by 3:05 tomorrow. Students who have applied for the